Hello there, and welcome. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of Ask Dr. Dawn. Yep, another hour of health and science in the news, answers to your emails and your calls today on Ask Dr. Dawn. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. There were some very interesting things in the news this week that I wanted to share with you. First of all, we have been, as a scientific culture, really going after the holy grail of growing tissue in the lab, and people have been working for a while on growing blood vessels. This is extremely important because, well, blood vessels get damaged. Sometimes they fill up with plaque. Sometimes they get cut or slashed or crushed. And sometimes you just need a big one and can't really find one. And of course, because they are human tissue, they are subject to transplant rejection. A number of years ago, we broke a story about the first blood vessels that had been grown from cloned human tissue. And these were stem cells harvested from people and then grown in cell culture. And the trick with a blood vessel is that you don't need a flat sheet of cells, you need a tube. So the technology to clone people's own skin cells and grow them on a scaffolding, if you will, of something that you can later dissolve has been elaborated. What this breakthrough is all about is that these are donated skin cells that are from a single tissue donor. They're cloned stem cells which have actually not got surface antigens. So they've got a clone going. They've grown multiple blood vessels. They're manufacturing them, 12 inches long and about 4.8 millimeters wide. They're being used for dialysis patients. This work is being done in Europe, although the company that is running the study, Cytograph Tissue Engineering, is a San Francisco-based biotech company. So what they're going to be able to do is have off-the-shelf blood vessels, 12 inches long. Those can be grafted in between the artery and the vein in the arm of a dialysis patient. And then when you use up that vessel from poking it too many times in dialysis, you just put in a new one. This is much better than trying to find a similar-sized artery or vein and harvest it in the individual in question. So it represents a significant breakthrough. And in a related story in Sweden, a young girl's portal artery, in other words, the artery from the intestine to the liver, which had been damaged in a sort of freak clotting event when she was less than a year old, was successfully replaced and her liver detoxification function restored. So we're entering the era of being able to grow organs. This is a substantial and significant improvement on what has been the status quo. Another story that was very big in the news this week was around Avastin. First of all, a little background on the drug. Avastin is a monoclonal antibody. It's grown in mice, and it is an antibody against a normal constituent of human tissue called vascular epithelial growth factor. And this is a chemical signal, like many of what we talk about in this program, that causes blood vessels to grow. Now, under normal circumstances, we all have a little bit of this coming out of our cells when we're wounded. One of the hallmarks of cancer cells is the ability to call new blood vessels into being. In fact, angiogenesis, which I'll come back to in a moment, may be one of the most critical things that distinguishes a normal tissue cell or even an abnormal precancerous cell from a cancer cell with the capacity to actually kill you. Cancers occur in a series, and the first thing that happens in the development of cancers is that cells lose their growth controls and they begin growing rapidly. Around that same time, the normal cell suicide mechanisms, the P53 mechanisms, are knocked out. And at that point, you have a cell that doesn't respond to ordinary self-destruct signals that are coming in from the outside saying, hey, you know, you're growing too fast, you should just go away. Stops listening to that signal and keeps growing uncontrollably. The next step is the loss of normal tissue adhesion, the sort of Velcro that causes cells to stick together. Once you have a cell that's growing rapidly, no longer sticking to other similar cells, and no longer listening to the die now signal, you have a cancer. And that cancer can and does, we know, get into the bloodstream and the lymphatics and travel throughout the body. Most of these are killed by the immune system, and the ones that aren't killed by the immune system and fetch up on a shore somewhere in the bone marrow or in the epithelium or in the kidney or in the liver or any other vascular bed like the lung that has small capillaries, well, it may or may not ever manifest as cancer. And one of the critical factors about whether that occurs is whether or not that cell mutates further and is able to produce vascular epithelial growth factor. VEGF is the critical thing in making a cancer. So not surprisingly, it was a target and a kind of holy grail target for cancer therapy. And in about 2004, this drug, Avastin, became available and was approved by the FDA for metastatic colon cancer and metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. And in those two cancers, it was shown to prolong life, prolong survival, which was the criteria for approval of this drug. Then in 2008, the boundary slipped a little bit and the FDA approved it for breast cancer, metastatic. And that's a little bit more controversial because statistically there was no increased survival time in the breast cancer patients, but there was a slowed rate of growth of the cancer that was statistically significant. And actually, because of the lack of survival improvement, the committee of the FDA recommended against approval for this broadened indication. However, that recommendation was not followed, and the committee of the FDA did approve it, or rather I should say the FDA did approve it over the committee's objections, and it became available for breast cancer. Now, that decision is being rethought, and in March of this year, the FDA reversed that decision and said we are no longer going to approve it for breast cancer metastatic patients. Now, this has led to an enormous uproar, as you might expect, in the population of people, women, with breast cancer. And in many ways, it has given birth, I think, to a good example of one of the key controversies that we face as a society and as a scientific culture in terms of what are we going to use for our criteria here as these new therapies come online. Now, Avastin is very expensive. It's about, at the doses used for breast cancer, $90,000 per year. If the FDA does not rescind its decision to remove breast cancer as an indication, most private insurance companies will basically be able to say, we're not going to pay for that. That's $100,000. It doesn't prolong your life, so sorry. The problem there is that there is a subset of the population who can probably have their life significantly extended, but that might be only 10 or 15% of the cohort of breast cancer patients. So if you do research on all breast cancer metastatic patients, you're not going to see that survival benefit. It's not going to make sense to pay for the drug for all of these patients. And that leaves a certain smaller subset who would benefit out in the cold, or at least out trying to figure out how they're going to come up with an extra $100K a year. I don't have a strong answer to what we should be doing about this, except to say that I think we need to think about the cost of these drugs. We need to think about what are the criteria for use. Is it survival? Is it disease-free survival? Is it lack of growth of the tumor? And we need to apply whatever standards that we come up with across the board, regardless of the size of the cohort or how politically connected they are or how good they are at organizing pink, purple, multicolored, pick your ribbon color campaigns. We need some criteria for social justice here, and I hope that we'll achieve it. Another interesting story that was promoted this week was a study about autism. I actually tweeted this, and if you're not following me on Twitter, I would urge you to look me up. You can find the link to that on my website, askdrdawn.com. But the story I tweeted a couple of days ago was an autism study that was published in the Archives of General Psychiatry, and it's a very interesting study. They used data from the California Disease Registry, the Department of Developmental Services, which has regional centers all over the state for people who have cognitive, autism, other forms of mental developmental delay. Using that data, they were able to identify about 900 cohorts of twins. And after sifting through all the data, they ended up with about 192 twins who had autism. And one twin does and one twin doesn't. And then they could look at the DNA. And essentially, there's been a lot of people very comfortable with the scientific evidence that autism is largely a genetic disease. When you start looking at DNA, you can find out if that's true or not, particularly using these twin studies. And what these researchers said that is against the status quo is that they felt that way over half, as much as 70% of the influences that led to autism were actually environmental, not accountable by genetics. This is very contrary to previous work. And yet, when you look at the methodology and how they did it, it appears to be one of the best constructed studies to date. As I reviewed the study and the statistics, I got, deeply mired in, I don't understand this, statistical stuff. But overall, I really think this study may have nailed it. The basic premise here is flawed, though, because science is currently approaching this as an either or. Is autism genetic or is it environmental? I would submit that based on what we know about genetics and inheritance patterns and the environment, that with autism, what we are looking at is an epigenetic phenomenon. In other words, yes, you have to have the DNA, but it also has to be turned on. And besides being turned on or amplified by some sort of epigenetic phenomenon, you also have to encounter the appropriate environmental trigger. Now, if that hypothesis, which I've just stated, is true, it'll be a long time proving it, because our current, even with all of our computers and all of our high-tech analysis of the genome, something that contingent and that complex is probably beyond our current science to prove. What we can only do is reach that conclusion by inference when our science fails to support the idea that we have a simple binary genetics versus environmental connection. And essentially the answer that you get depends on how you ask the question when your science and your technology simply aren't up for the task of answering the question. More to come, because autism is a very important topic. So let's take some emails. This from Ben in Richmond, Virginia. Dear Dr. Dawn, I enjoy your program, look forward to it weekly, and have improved my health as a result of the information you share with your listeners. I recently had my regular colonoscopy, as I have a 30-year history of mild ulcerative colitis, which has not required medical treatment, that is, medications, in 28 years. Good for you, Ben. The purpose of the colonoscopy, according to the surgeon that does them, is to detect dysplasia. If it's found, he says, cancer is coming, and that he and I will need to talk about removing the entire colon. If dysplasia is found, what do you think my options are and what should I do? I'm wondering if dysplasia can be transitory and if these cells can be replaced by normal ones through diet, supplements, medications, or medical treatment. I got a second email from Ben this week. By the way, dysplasia was not found. I'll have another colonoscopy in 2 to 3 years, but I want to do whatever I can to keep the dysplasia from developing. So, first of all, we'll talk about what we know from epidemiology on the subject of colon cancer. And in terms of ulcerative colitis is an autoimmune disease where people's immune system attacks the wall of the intestine. In that circumstance, you have a lot of damage being done and you have a lot of inflammation. And anytime you have damage being done, you have healing being done. Remember what I said at the top of the hour about vascular epithelial growth factor? Well, the one time that a healthy adult makes that is when their cells are damaged and they're having to rebuild them. Well, if there happens to be a cancer cell sitting around that doesn't make vascular epithelial growth factor, and there's a lot of loose VEGF hanging around because of the healing, then you might just stimulate a cancer cell. So that's one hypothetical way that injury could lead to an increased risk of cancer, which is exactly what people with ulcerative colitis have, an increased risk, more lottery tickets in the bad lottery. What we know about epidemiology in colon cancer in general is that people who take some kind of regular anti-inflammatory, and in the case of Ben, I would suggest probably an anti-inflammatory such as a daily aspirin pill. But people who take a regular anti-inflammatory have lower risks epidemiologically of colon cancer, presumably because they're reducing inflammation. Other epidemiological findings are diets that are high in fiber. Both soluble and insoluble fiber have been linked to lower risk of colon cancer. So high fiber diet, lots of baby aspirin a day, and avoiding things that are actively carcinogenic. And that would include, for example, nitrosamines, which are compounds that are formed when you heat nitrates, which are found in a lot of cured meats. So not eating meats that have been preserved in that way, you know, sausages, salami, most lunch meats, would probably be a good idea for someone who already carries an increased cancer risk. For the rest of the population, it's probably not a big deal in moderate quantities. If it's a daily thing, possibly you're looking at a slightly increased risk, but the data really isn't there to make that kind of a statement. Now, theoretically, and now we're moving from epidemiology, where we actually have some evidence, into theory, where we're going by biological mechanisms, which we know and understand. So theoretically, things that might reduce your risk of colon cancer would be making sure that you're getting adequate vitamin D, adequate vitamin A, adequate omega-3 fatty acids. So eating lots of fish, shellfish, sardines, fruits and vegetables, this is the sort of dietary recommendations one would make for someone with ulcerative colitis, although I will caution that people with ulcerative colitis have food sensitivities, so you should be checking and finding out what your food sensitivities are and then avoiding those foods as an ulcerative colitis sufferer. And then stress reduction, because there's a strong literature linking the immune suppression that comes with chronic stress with the development of all sorts of diseases, including many different kinds of cancer. So I think we've covered what I can tell Ben to help him with trying to reduce his risk of getting dysplasia, which is a precancerous condition, in terms of what to do if it's found. Well, if it's found in only one area, I think that it is rational to see if you can work with your surgeon to just remove areas of dysplasia and not remove the entire colon. If dysplasia is found on one of your surveillances, and I would say once it's found, you could survey annually. But if it's found on one of your annual surveillances in multiple areas, then at that point, it probably is a signal that it's time to remove the target tissue before one of those actually does turn into a cancer. Because I don't know of anything that's science-based that turns that around. We're going to Jim in Monterey. Hello, Jim, and welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Let me first thank you for your terrific community service. I don't know how to preface this, but there's a lot of mentally disturbed individuals who are both medically non-compliant and smoke cigarettes.
Oh, yeah.
I'm wondering if there's any research being done with those electronic aerosol nebulizer cigarettes. It seemed like they'd be a perfect, you know, medical delivery system. Do you think there's any research happening in that vein?
Okay, if I'm understanding you correctly, what you're saying is, why don't we take the Thorazine, or whatever we're going to use, Haldol, and put it in a nicotine delivery device so that the person gets their cigarette fix and gets their antipsychotic drug at the same time?
Exactly.
Okay. It's a very creative idea. Let me just start by saying that getting people with mental illness to use their medications is very difficult because, first of all, the side effects of the medications are considerable and somewhat unpleasant. And there's been all sorts of things tried, patches, injections, and such. I don't know this for certain, but I suspect that it is probably true that all of the psychiatric medications we use are heat labile. In other words, that when you heat it up enough to aerosolize it, you probably destroy the action of the molecule.
Right, but there are some of them are piezo nebulizers. They just fractionate the, they atomize
right, the
liquid to a vapor.
Basically, like an ultrasonic vaporizer.
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't know about the pharmacology of that. One of the problems I would see is dosing, because, you know, people would have to smoke the same number of cigarettes every day, and if they smoked more, they'd overdose on their meds.
Sure, but you could give them a 5-milligram vial to use throughout the day, and it could have the nicotine in there, too.
But would they do it?
Well, at the end of the day, they'd switch, you know, and they'd worn it out, because some of these guys are chain smokers, then they'd just go back to a nicotine vial.
It's a really, really interesting idea. I don't see any absolute reason why it couldn't be done. It's just a really creative idea. I wonder if anyone would actually do it, though.
You mean anyone would do the research?
Yeah, or for that matter, create the substance, because you're talking about a proprietary delivery system, and you'd
have to... Well, there's about a dozen e-cigarettes out there right
yeah.
now.
Oh, yeah, there's huge competition for it because of the nicotine market. But they're all proprietary, and I'm not sure how you load the vials and how do you get the manufacturers of the phenothiazines to supply it. There's a lot of practical difficulties, but it's a really creative idea, and I'd love to see someone explore it further.
Me too.
All right. Well, thanks for putting it out there.
Okay.
You realize you've just given this to the universe, and you won't be able to collect any patent fees.
That's quite all right.
All right.
What I want to do is go buy it right away.
Okay, well, I guess the three things you need is you need a way to get it into whatever the vial looks like. So you need to know how to load the vial, and you need to find a doctor who will write for it and a compounding pharmacy who can put it all together for you. Good luck.
Right. So I got to get busy.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm struggling with supporting my bipolar son.
Well, talk to the first place I'd go is the manufacturers of the three companies and their R&D departments.
Right.
That's the first place I'd go, because they actually have a public service, a customer service.
Well, you know, I can't believe this is really a new idea that, you know, they got all these high-paid pharmacists or whatever in the drug companies. I just thought maybe they're not advertising it until it's ready to go.
I can think of considerable liability concerns. This is one where don't hold your breath for a major manufacturer near you to start putting this out. But remember, we're still in a country where somebody with a medical license can actually write an order for any drug that exists to be given, even if it's off-label, even if it's in a novel form. Now, hopefully that prescription that's written is written on the basis of good information and good medical knowledge. But realistically, doctors could actually still call the shots on some things.
That's a great power you have.
Okay. All right. Have a great day.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. So taking another email, this one from John in St. Louis, Missouri. Dear Dr. Don, love your show. Listen to the podcast every week and learn lots of valuable information. I have a question. I'm 42 and in good health. I have a family history of hiatal hernia, and I have moderate symptoms resembling hiatal hernia, but have not been scoped for an official diagnosis. I would like to be scoped to ensure that this is the correct diagnosis and have them check for unusual or precancered cells. But being self-insured, I only have catastrophic insurance with a $5,000 deductible. So the procedure would be paid out of pocket. And I'm also concerned that my medical records showing this procedure might cause me to be denied for future insurance plans by companies who would consider me a risk. My records are currently, quote-unquote, clean, with my doctor and I only discussing the acid reflux and no prescription history. So I'm considering medical tourism, as the cost of the procedure would be less expensive, and my hope is that my United States medical records would not show my getting it done. Do you know if this is an accurate assumption? Of course, I would do exhaustive research regarding the hospital providing the endoscopy. Another question is, if the institution is well respected for esophageal conditions, do you recommend surgery? I have daily burning pain, about 4 to 5 out of 10 on a pain scale. I eat a holistic diet, with my only hiatal hernia sin being the caffeine in black tea, which I drink moderately. So first of all, John in St. Louis, I would recommend going to my website and looking at the resources. I have a good little handout on the anti-GERD lifestyle, and you should be following all of those recommendations, like elevating the head of the bed and no foods or liquids for 2 hours before going horizontal. Other things that can be helpful with this are betaine hydrate chloride with meals, which helps increase stomach emptying, and the use of DGL, which is deglycerized licorice, and also other herbs like marshmallow or aloe vera to coat the esophagus and thus reduce damage from the putative reflux that we're assuming that you have based on your symptoms. So, to answer your other questions, at present, Big Brother is not watching what you do outside of the United States. And the only way that an insurance company would know about that would be if you told them. That's true, actually, of purchasing services within the United States. As long as the person that you're purchasing services from bills you directly and does not bill through your insurance. So if a person is wanting to keep something off the books, so to speak, they need not to charge through their insurance for it, even if they have a high deductible. So that means they're going to lose credit to the deductible. But on the other hand, they keep their insurability. So until such time as our laws are actually in place that prevent this sort of discrimination, and by the way, that will be in 2014, assuming that the Health Care Reform Act does not get demolished or disintegrated between now and then. After 2014, if the law stays in place, this sort of redlining on a person's past medical history will no longer be legal. Okay. The other question, where to go and how to do this abroad, I really can't give you a lot of good advice. There's a couple of internet agencies that are doing internet tourism. I have no idea how good their vetting is. Large institutions like Johns Hopkins and the Mayo Clinic have been setting up alliances so that they give their good housekeeping seal of approval, so to speak, to a facility in Poland or a facility in Thailand. Again, I'm not sure how much due diligence is involved with that and whether or not that good housekeeping seal of approval is really meaningful from a quality standpoint. But medical tourism is a reality, and more people are going to centers of quote-unquote excellence abroad, and I hope indeed that they are centers of excellence because the phenomenon is definitely in place. Let's talk to Maria Elena in Salinas. Hello there, and welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi.
I want to know if there is a way to know that a person is getting enough protein in their body other than, you know, 4 ounces of such and such and, you know, mix, you know, combining proteins and stuff like that kind of thing. Is there anything that manifests in the body that could be a sign that, yep, I'm getting enough protein?
Well, basically what we have is blood tests that tell us when there's inadequate protein. So, and that's kind of a very poor standard for enough. And this is a point that I think gets missed a lot, is that the amount of something that's necessary to prevent a deficiency disease is not necessarily the optimum amount. It's sort of the minimum standard. And so the blood tests go wrong at the point where you're getting into a deficiency disease. And the best blood test is something called albumin. And these will give you some sense for nutrition. Okay, so that's one thing that's important. Looking at alternative medicine testing, because we jump conventionally in medicine, we do not test for protein sufficiency. It's just not done. In unconventional medicine or alternative medicine, there are tests, and typically what they do is they look at what you're peeing out. In other words, if you're putting out breakdown products of protein at a certain level, that implies that your dietary intake of protein is adequate. So there's things that you can look at that will give you some sort of indirect sense. But again, they're alternative medicine. They're not really validated by the sort of high-level scientific standards. And whether or not they're really meaningful or have predictive value is debatable.
Interesting. No. I just was wondering if, you know, something like, well, my fingernails are growing nice and smooth and quickly or something like that, you know, that manifests without a lab test. I mean.
Right. Not really. I mean, overall, how well do you feel? And do things seem to be working? Is your blood clotting? Do you bruise easily? Is your skin fragile? Nails are affected a lot by the B vitamins, so you could have strong nails because you're taking a lot of biotin. That doesn't necessarily speak to protein adequacy. Essentially, by the time you start manifesting something physically, you're talking deficiency disease. So that's a long way from what's truly enough. You can look up protein sufficiency requirements, and you'll get things like grams per kilogram. I think it's something like 1 gram for adults, and I'm not sure of this number, 1 point something grams per kilogram of body weight. And again, I do not remember the number, but that's the proportion. It's grams per kilogram of body weight.
Yeah.
And, you know, that works out to 40 to 70 grams of protein, which if you do the math is 300-400 calories worth of protein a day.
300-400 is all. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's not that much. It's not that much. If you actually do the math, it's like one standard serving of a protein-containing food per day is, quote-unquote, enough in an adult. Now, this is different if you're trying to heal from surgery or if you're a child and you're growing. But in the terms
of... Well, you know, I mean, I have friends who have to have their, you know, 8 ounces of steak a day kind of thing, and they feel it if they don't get it.
Well, I actually enjoy a high-protein diet as well, and I'm not sure, from my standpoint, it may just very well be that when I eat my high-protein, high-fruit and vegetable diet, what I don't get is a lot of sugar and starch because there's no room for it, and therefore I feel better because my insulin levels are low. I mean, it could be a lot of different explanations besides that I'm getting a lot of protein. I suspect that most of the protein I eat actually gets broken down into glucose and not used in my body, and that my body has to deal with an extra nitrogen load. So I'm probably burdening my kidneys with my high-protein diet, but I drink lots of water and hope that my kidneys can handle it because I feel better when I eat that way. So I'm like your friends. I feel better. I'm going to go with what makes me feel good, listen to my body, so to speak, and drink a lot of water so that I protect my kidneys.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yeah, and, you know, the idea that you can tweak things by consuming lots of amino acids, that's one where we're not really talking protein anymore. We're talking about the ultimate building block of a protein, an amino acid. And I do use amino acid therapy in my alternative medicine practice in certain particular situations, and even in my conventional practice when it comes to something like high blood pressure. And I do see results, which are not as, you know, dramatic as what I get with drugs, but in people who choose not to use pharmaceuticals or who are intolerant to them, I see nothing wrong with using amino acids as if they were pharmaceuticals in pharmaceutical-level doses. So the RDA on protein is 0.8 grams per kilogram, so I was pretty close at 1 gram per kilogram. That's the minimum to prevent deficiency diseases, so we're not sure that that's optimum, and many other sites suggest optimum is more like twice that much. So it's somewhere in the 1 to 2 gram range, and arguments are abounding as exactly where it is. Interesting thing, we talked about colon cancer earlier with that one email. This from a couple of days ago in the San Jose Mercury News. It looks like colon cancer deaths are down pretty much across the board, except in Mississippi, where they didn't change at all. CDC says that's probably due to Mississippi having the nation's lowest screening rate at 58%. So they're not finding the colon cancers early enough to make a difference in mortality. From 2003 to 2007 in the United States, the colon cancer death rate fell from 19 to 17. That's 32,000 fewer deaths, and that's probably almost all due to early case finding and not at all due to improvements in therapy, or for that matter, the Avastin that we discussed at the top of the hour. This is Judith in Atlanta. Judith writes, I'm a 59-year-old woman who tries to eat a healthy diet. I noticed that I had some issues on my face, and after some research, I decided I would try taking biotin. The addition of biotin has had a wonderful effect on my skin, which is much smoother, but then I noticed I developed a body odor that bothered me. I did additional research and found that B vitamins can cause this problem. Is there some way I can get the benefits of the biotin without the drawbacks? Well, First of all, Judith, I think that the B vitamin that is most strongly implicated with a change in body odor is not biotin, but thiamine. So I would, if you haven't already done this, do the biotin as a separate component. And caution about doing that, by the way. B vitamins do need to be balanced. And so if you megadose on one B vitamin, you can have some uncomfortable downstream effects. For example, you don't want to give a lot of folic acid and not give B12 because you can overload the B12 enzymatic system and create more problems than you solve. High doses of riboflavin have been indicated to unbalance some enzymatic systems as well. So you have to be informed about B vitamin megadosing. That being said, you could try pulsed therapy because of its effect on hair and skin being kind of a constant thing and hair and skin growing at a low level all the time. You can maybe take it every other day or every 2 or 3 days and see if you can get your benefit without building up enough to be effectively off-gassing. This one from Kara in Capitola. A few years ago, I had a bad case of bronchitis. It was slow to resolve, and I had a lingering cough for several months. Since then, I've had bronchitis about every 6 to 8 months. The last time was January, and the cough is still lingering. It feels like I have something caught in my throat, so I cough. The cough is only semi-productive and seems to be more prominent after I eat, regardless of what I eat, and I don't eat a lot of dairy. My doctor gave me an inhaler, which doesn't seem to do much. Sometimes I do have slight chest discomfort, but I exercise regularly without discomfort or coughing. Any thoughts? Well, Kara, the fact that you exercise regularly is a good indicator that you don't have asthma, which when someone tells me they have a chronic persistent cough is the first thing on my mind is that the bronchitis is aggravating a low, undiscovered amount of reactive airway disease. And your lack of response to inhaler also speaks against it being asthma. Pulmonary function testing should probably be done just to make sure of that. Now, the way that you describe the symptoms being worse with eating really made me think of possibly heartburn or postnasal drip causing some kind of hypersensitivity in your larynx. Maybe some low-level swelling and some inflammation leading to the nerves being overstimulated and your cough reflex having a lower than normal threshold. And I think that's probably what's going on. So going to an anti-GERD lifestyle, being evaluated for postnasal drip, and you can read about these things online or on the AskDrDawn.com website, and going after the things that could be causing irritation in the larynx is probably where you're going to get your benefit. This next email from Nicholas in Santa Cruz. Each spring through summer, my family is affected by allergies, a subtle degrading of our quality of life, like we're running on 75% of our potential. Over-the-counter drugs don't really help us. What can we do now that the season is winding down to prepare for next year? What are your thoughts on NAET acupuncture treatments? We're already taking anti-inflammatory substances such as turmeric and quercetin and some probiotics, plus removing most gluten and dairy from our diets. Well, Nicholas, what I would recommend for your family is the use of sinus lavage, like either the turkey baster or a neti pot, and during your allergy season, rinsing your nose once a day with salt water, because that will tend to reduce the amount of pollen, because I think your problem is pollen, that's sitting on the nasal surfaces and triggering the release of all of the inflammatory mediators. You mentioned quercetin. There's also an over-the-counter product called Nasochrome, which is chromalin sodium, and that's extremely helpful and extremely safe for children to use. So those are two additional things you could do. With respect to NAET, I made some efforts to investigate NAET, which is a form of acupuncture which has a very slick promotional feel to it, which I find kind of a turnoff. And it is proprietary, which means that it's a trade secret. You have to take the class. You can't look up any studies that actually describe in the methods section what it is. So I am unable, essentially, to form a critical opinion. And the way it's presented and the way it's sold gets my alert signal going at, I'm not sure this is legitimate because it's kind of network marketing alert sort of thing. So I cannot speak to its merits. I would not recommend it as a therapy above regular acupuncture because it doesn't seem to me to be doing anything more than making anecdotal statements about how great it is. Not enough for me to want to advocate. Let's go to Gail in Pacific Grove. Hello, Gail, and welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm so desperate with pain in my neck from many car accidents, and I've had many treatments. And I'm thinking of coming to see you as soon as I can get into your office for just so you can point me in a direction of treatment. I have an appointment with a neurosurgeon in August. That's as soon as I could get an appointment. And I'm to the point where I'm willing to let them fuse my discs in my neck just so hopefully I'll get some relief from this pain. And I know that's not even a good solution. I know that often those fusions cause... I've heard horror stories from people. Mm-hmm. I walked out of a neurosurgeon's office one time when I heard a woman who said that she was in much worse pain after a fusion. I throw up. I have diarrhea. I can't sleep. I can't do anything with the pain. And I see a pain doctor, and I take pain medication all the time. I see a chiropractor, and I'm just desperate at this point, calling to ask for some direction from you.
Okay, well, it's hard for me to give specific advice over the radio, not having seen your scans, not having seen your medical records. So all I can do is give a very general sort of dissertation on the disease process.
Okay.
Okay. And the first thing is that there are a couple of cutoff points where you sort of have to go to surgery because function is impaired. So taking the extreme ends of the situation here, if a person shows signs of denervation, and there's this particular kind of spike that you see when you put a voltmeter across a nerve, and if you see this kind of denervation spike, that means the person is in danger of actually permanently losing function and having essentially no motor movement or clumsy motor movement. And at that point, you have to just bite the bullet and do the fusion because function is at risk. You almost never see that, but when you do see it, you absolutely can't temporize on surgery.
Okay.
All right, so that's an absolute yes-no binary point, and there are very few of those, so let's start with what we've got that's concrete.
Oh, good.
So nerve conduction study, very important before surgery. I was always taught that it is a mistake to operate for pain in the absence of findings that suggest that what you see on the scan is actually what's causing the pain. Because the problem is that you probably have a very ugly MRI.
I do.
When someone comes in with neck pain that's radiating into their arms, for example, one, as a doctor, orders an MRI or another imaging study, and then you say, ah, see, right there, see that disc? That's causing your pain. And it's like, well, maybe. Trouble is, and I've cited this often enough, regular listeners will have heard it, but that if you go out to the mall and pick the first 50-year-olds and do MRIs on them, the ones that don't have back pain will have abnormal backs because you don't have a normal back at 50. And of course you do because the definition of normal is average, but if you were to say a healthy back or an anatomically standard back, you don't have that anymore.
No.
And I don't either, and I don't have back pain, but my MRI is probably not perfect.
Right.
And so what happens when I go into the doctor and say I have back pain, they get an MRI and it's not perfect. Well, is that where my pain came from, or is it the 50 pounds of fertilizer that I bent over and picked up incautiously the day before? And you've seen the pain doctor, you're on the narcotics, I mean, you've gone down that route. You've probably had the steroid injections.
They help a lot, and my pain doctor in the last two scheduled visits, they've just called and canceled for no reason, so I'm not even getting that relief right now.
Okay, well, you need to investigate whether or not use of a stimulator, of a spinal stimulator, would work for you.
I'm at that point right now. I'm going to pursue that with a neurosurgeon.
Yeah, I think that that is maybe a better solution than a fusion. It depends on the individual case, though, but definitely that's something to be pursued.
That's on my list of something to pursue right now.
Yeah, because if it's pain and there's no denervation, then just blocking the pain with one of these devices, which essentially jams the signal.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't jam the motor stuff going back out the nerve to operate your hand. So that's
right.
A really good way.
Yeah, I've thoroughly researched it. And, you know, this has been going on for many years. So mm-hmm. It's a slippery slope. And in the last 6 months, it's just gotten like 50% worse. My quality of life is really very poor right now. So
yeah, but that's
time to go to Plan B.
Yeah, but operating on pain is always risky.
I know.
And so you do everything else first, and certainly a fusion would be the absolute court of last resort, in my opinion.
I'm happy to hear you say that.
Anyway, whatever advice you get from one neurosurgeon, I strongly recommend you get a second opinion from a non-surgical person, like a neurologist.
A neurologist, okay.
Yeah.
Would coming into your office with my records be a wise plan? I would love to meet you.
You're certainly welcome to do that, and I'll do my very best to help you.
Okay, I'm going to do that. Thank
Alrighty.
You. Bye-bye.
Bye. An anonymous emailer from San Jose writes, I was on hepatitis C treatment for 6 months in 2004. During the treatment, I started to smell a chemical odor, which stayed with me and has altered my sense of smell and taste subsequently. Once I discontinued the medications, my smell and taste came back to normal. Then in 2007, I got into the Elbam spray. Remember that, folks? That was the light brown apple moth. And 2 days later, I started smelling something like diesel fumes. This smell stayed with me for about a year. Now my sense of smell is altered once again. And my assumption is that this spray pushed my already compromised olfactory system over the edge. I now almost completely lost my sense of smell and taste, and I constantly smell a chemical smell. I have good and bad days. Certain odors change the way I smell them, and if I smell a strong odor somewhere, it stays lodged in my nose for 6 to 10 hours. Is there anything I can do? I was getting tested to rule out Parkinson's, and I will be getting an MRI to rule out a brain tumor. I'd just like to get my sense of smell back. Notice, though, that I did get it fully back after my Hep C treatment, but it started going haywire again after the Elbam spray. Thank you for your answer in advance. First of all, it's really interesting about the Elbam spray that they did, because after the spraying, although the ingredients were promoted as being safe for human consumption, et cetera, but when they did spray it, a lot of my patients did have exacerbations of allergies and particularly asthma. And I know, you know, the statement is it's not hurting anybody, but the clinical reality I was seeing was either the spray itself or anxiety about the spray definitely generated a peak in asthma complaints. I'm going to take the Fifth Amendment in terms of whether that was psychogenic or whether that was real, because I honestly don't know. There was, however, a peak. Now, that being said, there was a surfactant in the Elbam spray, and a surfactant is something that changes the surface tension properties. And our sense of smell is very dependent on the surface tension of our nasal mucus and also the health of the receptors. People with zinc deficiency will often develop a problem with their smell, sense of smell, sometimes permanently, but sometimes it's reversible. So getting a red blood cell zinc level, and if you're not in the upper half of what they reference as the normal range for the study, taking some zinc supplements could be beneficial. It's certainly in the won't hurt, might help category. Secondly, one of the very interesting things that I read just this last 4th of July weekend was a book by Dr. Shoemaker, who is very big on mold and mold-damaged buildings. And I had attended a lecture by him a couple of months ago and hoped to get him as an interview subject. But one of the things that came out of that book is that there is a compound called VIP, which is vasoactive intestinal peptide. It's not just found in the intestine. That's just where it was first discovered. Vasoactive intestinal peptide is a really important in the brain for the signaling at the level of the hypothalamus. You know those people who are chemically sensitive, who say that they get terribly sick when they smell perfume or when they walk into a public restroom that's using a volatile air freshener, they get made ill by it. I used to think those people were nuts. That was back when I was ignorant 10 or 15 years ago. Now I know they're not nuts. They really have a physiologic sensitivity. And this latest work by Shoemaker suggests that VIP is very, very significant in the development of this. Blood levels can be checked for that. And I suspect that what we will find for people like Anonymous in San Jose is that when we go and test, we will find that they have low levels of this VIP compound, and that replacement with this compound actually helps alleviate their symptoms. Now, that's anecdotal. It's based on one clinician who's doing this research and getting ready to publish it, but it's unpublished research. And right now, it's all case studies, and it's not a placebo-controlled, blinded type study, which is what is required before something becomes accepted as medical therapy. And it's a good thing that that's required. I'm not complaining about it, but it does create a bit of a, shall we say, a bit of a lag time in medical research. Amy in Portland writes, I want to thank you very much for your program and the good service you provide. I've listened to your podcast for several years. I'm going to skip ahead. I'm a 37-year-old woman who had bilateral hip resurfacing surgery in 2006 due to a congenital condition named protrusio acetabulae, which is abnormally deep hip sockets. I'm now reading with increasing alarm about the impact of high levels of metal ions in the bloodstream and the negative outcomes experienced by patient who underwent this same surgery. After an article appeared over the weekend in the New York Times, I contacted my doctor's office to have the levels of metal ions in my bloodstream checked. My question to you is, have you had any patients who've undergone this surgery? The answer to that is yes. And what is your counsel to them on tests to undergo, symptoms to watch for? Also, do you have concerns about long-term exposure to metal ions in the bloodstream generally? And is there anything I can do to mitigate the effects of such foreign materials in my system? Well, Amy, at this point on the subject of metal ions, what I would like to say is the following. Most people who have a metallic implant with titanium or one of the other more quote-unquote inert metals seem to do very, very well. There does seem to be a growing body of literature that supports the concept that some people are allergic to their implants. And there is a type of testing called MELISA, M-E-L-I-S-A testing, which looks for antibodies against metal. You can Google that and find the company that does it. They are an FDA-approved company. They're a legitimate lab. The test, however, is considered alternative and may not be covered by your insurance. The symptoms to look for with any kind of systemic allergy are skin and mucosa changes, so rashes, ulcerations, blisters. And I have one patient who has this unusual vasculitis in the leg where he has the implant. And I would love to get that testing on him, but have been unable to get it so far. But I'll keep you posted if I manage to get more information. Believe me, my regular listeners will be the first to know. We've come to the end of another hour, and I want to thank all of you for listening to the program. I've been so happy to be here and be talking to you, and I hope you'll tune in next week for more of the same. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.